The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. A hazy Monday here in Southern California, and also hazy if you're an NBA fan, because it looks like we're going to have even more games canceled. On the Subway Fresh Take hotline right now, the executive director of the NBA Players Association, his first appearance in the BS Report, Billy Hunter. What's happening?
Well, Bill, I think you're what's happening. We're waiting a while to get on your show. I understand there have been some faux pas or whatever between the two of us in terms of trying to coordinate this thing, but I'm looking forward to our discussion.
And I appreciate that you came on. I'm glad we're doing this, especially after the events of what happened last week. You know, both sides seem really entrenched in their positions right now. How do you find compromise when both sides are this entrenched?
Well, I thought we were trying to reach compromise when we were there last week, when we put forth the proposals that we presented to the owners. We thought that it demonstrated our willingness to compromise. And I'm just not so sure. I have my ideas about what transpired, and I suspect that more about an internal battle that may be brewing or that's occurring between the big and small markets, more so than any proposal that we've submitted to the owners. I think that's more the issue. Trust me, we want to play basketball. I think we've been extremely reasonable, and I can point to fact to support my position, and we're prepared to be reasonable, and that's what we've indicated all along. That we're willing to be reasonable, we just don't want to be totally exploited.
You said on Thursday you singled out a couple owners, and I thought it was interesting, the four guys you singled out: Mark Cuban, Jerry Buss, James Dolan, Mickey Arison. It seemed like you were almost thanking them for trying to think outside the box. What did those guys do exactly during those meetings?
Well, they just demonstrated a willingness to get a deal. I mean, based upon comments that they either made during the negotiations and or their body language. And then I think in some sidebars that one or two of them may have had with some of our players when they were exiting the room, when they were in the halls. And so based upon, you know, that information, what I received directly plus what was conveyed to me, I was of the impression that they were interested in getting a deal. And that's why I said that, you know, clearly, if you look at a guy like Mickey Arison, I know he wants his team to be on the court playing. I know that Mark Cuban wants to be back playing. Hey, he won the championship this past year. He's hopeful that he can repeat. So he wants to get his ball players back on the court as soon as possible. Things are looking up for New York. You know, for the first time in about 7 or 8 years, they made the playoffs. They're spending close to $900 million to $1 billion to renovate Madison Square Garden. So I would assume that James Dolan wants to get back and wants to play. And he's demonstrated that based upon the comments that he's made in both the large and small meetings. And so that's why I kind of signaled them out, because that was the message that I thought that they were sending to us, that they wanted very much to get a deal. But there appears to be some impediment in the way, and as I said before, I'm not so convinced that it's our deal and the players. I think it's more internal, and I think it really revolves around the issue of revenue sharing. I think that's the big elephant in the room right now.
When you talk about an impediment, like, you know, there were reports last week that Paul Allen, the Portland's owner, really kind of threw his body in front of some stuff and hurt the negotiations. Were there a couple owners that you feel like almost don't want this season to start?
I think that there may be some owners of some of the smaller markets. You know, and I hate to signal. I don't want to signal out any particular owners. I don't want to get into a name calling situation. But I'm convinced that there are some people in the smaller markets who obviously are dug in. You know, they want a certain look and feel of an agreement, and short of them getting that, if it means that they can force us into a shutdown for a year, I think they're prepared to do it, and I think that's what we're battling against. On the issue of revenue sharing, I think that as it relates to the big markets, who would obviously be the contributors, they would be contributing most of the funds on a revenue sharing deal. I think even the big markets are probably being somewhat strident in saying that unless we can get the kind of deal that we want in place with the players, then we're not willing to buy into the revenue sharing plan that's being pushed by the small markets. So this thing is interconnected, you know, it's like a three-headed monster in a way.
Right.
You know, the relationship between the small and the big markets, the relationship between the players and the NBA, and then the players and the big markets as well, in terms of what the big markets would have to contribute in order to make the revenue sharing plan work.
Well, what do you think the owner's plan was going into this lockout? Because you've been pretty clear about the fact that you feel like all along they wanted to cancel the season. You've prepared the players. The agents have been, you know, any extension they signed the last couple of years, trying to get that money deferred, kind of preparing for D-Day. Do you think the owners wanted this all along?
Opinion. I've been of that opinion since 2007, and I've said to David Stern on several occasions and to the owners that is quite evident to me. And what I have to constantly remind my staff is that, you know, you have to be focused on what has been said and trying, in many instances, reading through the lines. When I met with David in 2007, we met during it was on the playoffs in Cleveland, and it was a little private meeting, David and Adam Silver, myself, Dan Wasserman of my staff, and Gary Hall, my former general counsel, who expired about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And we agreed to meet with them, and we met, and it was at that time that David had indicated to me, i.e. Stern, that the deal, quote, was not working for his owners, and that his owners had indicated to him what they wanted. And they wanted us to roll back where players would take less than 50%. And he said, look, we got a couple of years left on the deal. What we can do is, why don't we agree to an extension now? Why don't we extend the deal? But we'll extend it with the understanding that each year the players will roll back a percent or two until you get below the 50% mark. And that we would want a hard cap. We want all these other things that would impact the system. And so I said to David, in order for you to get there, we're going to have to go through the same circumstance, same difficulty that we experienced in 1998. And so what you're asking for, the owners are asking to run the table, and that's the exact words I use. If they're looking to run the table, then it means that there's going to be a whole lot of hurt that each of us are going to have to experience in order for you to get there. And he says, well, I'm telling you, my owners have already, I told my owners that they could get what they wanted, but they had to be prepared to lock out for a year. He said, and they've told me that they're ready to shut it down for a year. So I'm just trying to tell you that, and maybe we can avoid that. And so what I'm saying to you, Bill, is that since the inception, that's the way the negotiations have gone. In June, in an effort to avoid a lockout, we moved off the 57 mark and we came to 54. We agreed to 54 split. We put something like, it was like about $100 million or so we were putting on the table for the owners. And then several weeks ago, we went from 54 down to an average of 53, and then we dropped to like 52.5 this past week. So at the 53 mark, while everybody's pushing for 50-50, at 53, we would be giving the owners back $185 million a year. And obviously at 50-50, they give something like $325 million a year. But at 53 over a six-year period, which is based upon what we've indicated, the length of the deal we wanted to do, they would get back something like $1.1 billion. They would earn $1.1 billion more than the players would earn. And we clearly addressed, even at the 53 number, they acknowledge that it addresses their losses. They've said that to us several times. Peter Holt was doing the meeting. And they said, and it gives them the possibility of, quote, making a profit. Well, so that's where we are.
Well, from where I'm sitting, it doesn't seem like you have a ton of leverage, because it always seemed like the owners are ready to kill games and maybe even the season to get what they want. What do you think your leverage is?
Well, my leverage one is the players, and that's always been my position. That's been my position since 1998. And I told the players in 98, one, we know we can't win the media war because the NBA just has too many resources. And so we can't beat them.
Wait, hold on a second. I want to hit that point. Why do you think you can't win the media war? I don't understand that.
Well, I just don't think we can. What I'm saying to you is that we can get out there. First of all, I don't get the number of opportunities that David Stern gets. So he's constantly before on every radio talk show. He's on TV. Plus a couple of the fact that the NBA has their own network, NBA.com TV. They have a contract with ESPN. They have a contract with TNT and ABC, and I can assure you that at any given moment, if they want to get their message out there, then they're going to be given the opportunity. I think that clearly between 1998 and today, things have changed somewhat because of the social network. So consequently, there are a lot more bloggers, there are a lot of people on Facebook and YouTube and whatever, a lot of independent Twitter. Writers who are putting out their story, and obviously their interpretation and analysis of how they perceive things. But when it comes to the major media, I don't think that we can necessarily compete with the NBA.
Right. So you feel like, but I mean, on the other hand, I would argue that the players that you have right now is some of the best collection of personalities and most like personalities that the league's had. I think that in the late 90s, it was a little bit different. The guys were getting paid a lot of money. Some of them weren't coming through in the contracts. Nowadays, I would say that the players are more liked. I mean, you have basically probably 17, 18 of the top 25 most marketable athletes in America. Like, why haven't you used those guys to try to sway people on your side?
Well, we use some of them, but it's difficult, first of all, because we're not able to connect with them every day. And so you have to be careful that when they put the message out, they don't put the wrong message out, or they don't end up saying something that you later regret, and that's why.
Yeah, got it. Did you hear the quotes that Bill Guerin, who was heavily involved in the NHL lockout in 2004 and 2005, came out and he said, the players should just accept the deal now because it's not going to get better a year from now, and I have a lot of regrets about my role and what happened, how I handled it, and I just wish that I had that year of playing back. Do you feel like your players understand the stakes here that, you know, somebody like Kobe Bryant, this might be his last great year and it's about to be wiped out?
Trust me, what we've done when we sit down with our players and we go around the country, we hold regional meetings, and we've been fully transparent with our players. We don't give them one side. We give them every aspect of what it means if you hold out, what it is, what you lose on a month-to-month basis, how each player will be impacted. We've done that for the last 2 years. And that was based upon the proposals that had been out there for the last 2 years in terms of how it would impact each player. And so we've done that. We do that. And our players are of the mind right now that if you cannot work out the system so that the system's right, if, for example, the players are going to take a reduction in revenue and they're going to address the revenue concerns of the owners, then we feel as though that the owners should be a little bit more liberal and be willing to grant some of our requests as it relates to the system. Keeping in mind now, for the last 2 years, all we've ever heard is about how much the owners are losing. They're losing $300 million a year. And that's been drummed, you know, so often and so intensely that everyone, if you go around, people will say, well, the NBA is losing $300 million a year. So we said, well, we'll address your economic needs. But then don't tell us that you not only do you want the economic needs, but then you have to have the system, because based upon the system that they're talking about imposing, it would be more restrictive than the NFL system or the NHL system. And we're saying, wait a minute, we worked too long and too hard. There have been too many players who've come before us that made sacrifices to achieve some of the benefits and privileges that the players now are benefiting from. And so consequently, that's why.
Yeah, but when you think about it, like from going back to that leverage angle, you know, these guys that own these teams are all rich guys. The players, basically, you're going to have between I don't know, an 8-year career and a 15-year career, depending on who you are. And if you lose
the average
season,
career is 4 years.
Right. But the, you know, you're talking about a guy like Kobe might play for 20 years. A guy like Jared Dudley might play for 10. But, you know, if you lose a season, you're losing 10% of all the money you ever would have earned in your career.
Well, there's no question about it. But what you have to also understand is that, and I think too often players are not given, professional athletes are not given the kind of credit that they should be.
Why?
Because I think that they're principled individuals. And I think that they realize that the struggles that they're incurring, they may be paid at a higher level, but it's the same issues that we see that are endemic right now, not only in our own country, but around the world. And it's about, you know, folk at the top who have the leverage and the power being to impose upon other folk, the workers of the world. And I know there's a struggle when we talk, well, you're going to say to me, we're talking about billionaires and millionaires. Yeah, well, a guy makes a few dollars during his playing career, but most of our players, when they end playing basketball, they're going to be living for another 40 years or so. And so I don't know how long that money's going to last them, even if they've made every prudent investment that they could possibly make, at what level they're going to be able to live. But I think after a while, it just becomes a principle. And with a lot of these players, that's what it's about. You know, they feel as though the owners have dug in. They've taken the hard line. They're determined to break the players in the union. And they refer to the NHL, what happened in the NHL, as an example of what could happen here. And the players are a little bit more strident. And so consequently, they say, look, if it's all about the principle, then I may be willing to take the hit for a while to demonstrate that the principle is as important to me. And what we put in place, since they were people who came before me and who made the sacrifice, and I'm benefiting, so maybe I need to make a little sacrifice to make sure that the system is reflective of what I think it should look like 10 or 15 or 20 years from now. And we constantly point up to the players and even to the owners. Look, you own the team. You know, you benefit from the services and skills of the players. But what you will do, your franchise will increase in value, and you will end up leaving it to your children or grandchildren or whatever. So you're right. Over the next 10, 15, 20 years, you're going to be able to make up for any loss that you've incurred. But notwithstanding that, and we say that to all of our players, they say to us, listen, as of this moment, we're prepared to hold the line. And so those are the marching orders I get from our players. And believe me, we are constantly polling our players, getting a consensus as to where the players are and what it is they think we should do. And this is after we made full disclosure to them as to where we are and what's being offered and why we appear to be, you know, where we are at this stage of the game.
It's easy to say that in October, though. I think once you get into January and now you've missed 2 months of paychecks, you saw this happen a little bit in 1999. The guys start to get panicked. You maybe start to cave a tiny bit.
Well, that's not true. The guys didn't get panicky until when? Like when we were leading the night before we did the deal? As a matter of fact, there was a split in our membership. There were guys who were saying, no way, we need to hold out for another week or two. And so
I disagree
with you on that one. Trust me, I'm constantly looking and, you know, conferring with the guys who work for the union, these retired players who are out there, who are connecting with our players, who are in their face. And at any given moment, if I see that the players are beginning to stress or weaken or they decide that we need to go in a different direction, then we'll do that.
But we'll you're not worried about that now?
With their imprimatur. If they agree that that's what they want done, then we'll do that. And I can assure you that, you know, I'm not going to do anything. I would never do anything to the detriment of the players. So it's not about with me. It's not about ego or pride or any of that. It's about trying to get a fair deal, for our players. And that's all I'm about.
The owners seem like, you know, I think even you'd agree with this. It seems like they want something bigger than a new labor deal. They want to create a new economic model for the league. What responsibility do you have to help them build that model?
Well, we thought that we put a proposal out the other night. I think it was Mark Cuban, ironically, came out with a structure that he called the game changer.
What's that?
He talked about moving in a different direction in terms of no salary cap, et cetera.
No salary cap.
We took that idea back into our room, and we in turn responded with something similar. And I saw the reaction that he had to it. I saw the reaction he had to it, and two or three other owners in the room who were really excited about it. But then, you know, keep in mind that when you start talking about no salary cap, the salary cap has existed in the NBA for at least the last 30 years, and it was the creation of David Stern. And so I don't know whether there's any pushback because of that, but we were prepared to pursue that whole idea of going into a different direction where we'd have to worry about a cap, so the exceptions, salaries, all of that would be, there would be no limit, with the exception of there being obviously being a cap at the top, i.e. a quite heavy tax that teams would have to confront if they went above a certain number. But what happened was the owners then decided, at least the leaders of their delegation decided they had to take it back in a different direction. They said, well, look, we don't want to address that. We don't want to deal with that idea. We want to now go back and proceed along the track that we've been proceeding along for the last, you know, for the last year or more.
Well, hold on a second.
But we would be open. We would be open, clearly. We're open to the idea that Mark Cuban put on the table.
All right, so let's talk about that. So Cuban comes up with this idea. You guys listen to it. You go into your little channels and you talk about it with your inner circle. No salary cap. I assume that there would be a certain minimum that teams would have to spend on salaries over a certain level. And then there would be a tax at the higher level, then a tax after that. And so basically you're putting teams between 55 and 75 million, depending on who they are. And then if they want to go over that, they could. Why wouldn't that work?
Well, it would work for us, but you have to ask, you're asking the wrong guy. You're asking the wrong guy. I told you that we were receptive to that. We said, let's pursue this line of thinking. Let's look at this thing that Mark has come up with. Let's flush it out.
Well, why couldn't you pursue it today?
And the pushback didn't come from us. The pushback came from the NBA.
But why couldn't you pursue that today? Why couldn't you pursue it tomorrow? Like, it seems like that's like a good idea.
Well, you have to do me a favor. Why don't you call over and ask David Stern why didn't he pursue that? Why didn't he agree to pursue that? We've indicated that we're ready to sit down and negotiate with them on a minute's notice. We'd indicated that we were prepared to negotiate, to continue negotiations the night we were there, but for the fact that they told us it was take it or leave it, and unless we agreed to the 50-50. And we said, well, no, we can't agree to 50-50 if we don't have the system in place. So when you ask me why, you know, then I've got to ask you, why don't you call over there and ask them that?
Because hey,
I'm indicating to you that we're open to that. We're open to that idea.
Well, answer me this question. Why did it take until mid-October for you guys to get in a room for three straight days and really talk about ideas that might change the league? Why wasn't this happening in July?
Because it was no different than in 1998. Until the owners begin to feel some pressure, you know, the fact that they would be facing this idea of losing games, et cetera, and revenue, did they then decide that it was time for them to negotiate, for us to negotiate seriously. Look, we were available in July and August, but what we've done is we followed the same pattern that we followed in 1998, and this is what I told our players. Now, we reached out in July, we reached out in August, but the response was that unless we were prepared to accept what it was that they put on the table, that there was no need to meet. It was only after we got around Labor Day, as I told our players, I'm almost prophetic. I said, listen, I can assure you that they're going to follow the same roadmap that they followed in 1998. After Labor Day, we'll get together. And as we get closer to October, then there will be a willingness to make some concessions. But the concessions that they made have been pretty de minimis. You know, you can't start at 37-38% and then talk about coming up. You can't talk about freezing players' salaries for 10 years, you know, at the number. And in 10 years from now, when we would begin to participate in the growth in revenue, it would take us really to 2033 in order to get back to where we are today. You can't talk about eliminating all the exceptions, imposing a hard cap, eliminating guaranteed contracts, etc., and expect players to be receptive to that. And that's been their position up until now. You know that as well as I do.
Well, in fairness, the owner side, Stern and Silver and those guys, have said all summer that, you know, it was hard for them to get you to talk about negotiating this stuff. So it seems like you guys, it's just that he said, she
said.
Well,
that's always what they're going to say. And I'm gonna say that's a canard, okay?
A canard,
all
nice.
Right. I'm going to put the canard on them, Bill.
I like that.
I'm going to be nice, man. I'm going to use canard.
I would have to look that up.
You had to laugh at that one yourself.
I got to ask you about David, because this is somebody you've known for a long time now. You beat him on the last two labor deals. I mean, it's pretty clear looking back. No, you did. You beat him.
You won the last two labor deals. I know you're at ESPN. But you remember, you may remember the cartoon, at least it appeared in Sports Illustrated in 1998. And they showed me, it was amazing, because there were all of these owners on white horses. That's how they were depicted in the cartoon. And yeah. It was myself, Patrick Ewan, a couple of other members of our board, and we were like on the ground, and they were riding in like the posse, you know, coming in to save the day. And they were like a stampede. And the cartoon showed all of us on the ground trying to survived the stampede, and ironically, the same things that you're saying now were said in 98. People say, wait a minute, there's no leverage, give up, take what they got on the table, etc. And, you know, we did a deal at the 12th hour, but it was only at the 12th hour that David and the owners were willing to compromise. I think now there's a different group of owners who make up the NBA, and so consequently, I think they're a lot more dug in. And they don't own their success. They don't owe their success, I think, as much to David as before. But no, I mean, the reality is we did not. You know, I think it was just more an act of fate or whatever in terms of how the economy reacted, how the league grew, that our deal looked a lot better on this end than it did in the front end, because at least the spin that was put out, the way the NBA spun it, the way the media spun it, was that, you know, I don't want to use any profanity, but we had they ate our lunch, right? They ate our lunch.
Well, that's why I'm asking you.
Pardon?
But if I'm scoring those two deals in 2011, looking back, you won both of them, and it makes me wonder: is that why David is being so stubborn this time around? Because you beat him the last two?
No, I think the reason why David is being so stubborn is because David has a new crop of owners. He's got all these guys who come in who were extremely successful, people who made billions of dollars, and they came in, they bought these franchises, and they just have a different perspective. I think there's a great deal of what, I think one of the reporters wrote the story saying there was psychic value in owning sports franchises, but now all of a sudden there's a new paradigm, and they're saying that the franchises have to turn the same kind of profit they would in their regular businesses. So with the downturn in the economy in 2008, I think some of the owners, you know, probably suffer some significant losses in their ancillary businesses. And so consequently, they think that they should make it up on the backs of these franchises. I think in addition, it may very well be that when they bought these franchises and they paid a premium, I acknowledge that they paid, in some instances they paid a premium for the franchises, there may have been either representations made or expectations that they arrived at on their own, that they were going to get a certain return, that the franchise values would continue, et cetera. But I think what is happening, there's been a plateau because of the economy, but I think things are beginning to take off again. And I think the combination of these new regional sports networks that a lot of teams are signing deals with, where they're not only going to be paid fees but have equity, that coupled with just the popularity of the game, when you look around the world, you know, basketball will soon, NBA basketball will soon surpass hockey, I'm not hockey, but soccer, as the most popular sport on the globe. And you know, we see that with our players as they run around the country, around the world, making these appearances, and people outside the country seem to know them and know more about their careers than most of the folk who live here in the States.
My counter to that would be, I agree with you with everything you just said. I think the one difference between, you know, the late 90s and now is that, you know, fan behavior is different. I think it's a tougher ask to get people to buy season tickets now. I think it's easier to stay at home and watch basketball on your big TV. I think it's more fun to be online and have 9 games going at once and all that than going to a game 41 times a year, paying for parking, paying for food, paying for drinks. Don't you feel like it's a little different in 2011
well, you know,
than
Bill,
it was?
Well, you know, Bill, it's about what you're saying, it rings true in many ways, and that is, I can remember not this year, but it's 5 or 10 years ago, I had said to our guys, what we're going to ultimately see is a shift in the entire economy when it comes to sports. That being able to watch the game on your TV or on your BlackBerry or your iPhone or something, that's the trend of the future. So what you got to look at now then is, as the game grows in popularity globally, so if you're on the Sahara Desert, or if you're in Siberia, or somewhere in China, whatever, and you can tune in, and let's say, for example, the league is getting, they're getting $1.50 a month on an average from viewers around the world. But now the number has grown, so instead of having, you know, 200 or 300 million people watching an NBA game, you got maybe 1 billion people. Then what will happen is their coffers will grow. So even though we may, for a moment, take a hit in terms of the live gate, the disparity in revenue that will be generated through this new vein will clearly compensate for any loss. But the reality is, if you look at the popularity of the game, the last 5 years, the game has grown to a different level, and has been more popular than ever. And last season demonstrated that. And I'm not so convinced that, you know, if we're back playing by December or by January 1st, I don't think we're going to lose many fans. I think, as a matter of fact, what will happen is probably the refs will do the players good, and I think they're going to be so glad to get back when they get back on the floor, and they're ready to go now. Guys are working out.
Right.
They're running around doing all these charity games. They're ready to go. I'm ready for them to go. Trust me, there's nothing. I know how big a fan you are about basketball, so not only are you extremely knowledgeable when it comes to writing about it, but I know how much you love the game. And what I want to say to you is that you don't like it any less than I do. You don't, I mean, you don't love it any more than I do. You know, I have the same kind of commitment to it that you do, and trust me, I'm prepared to do anything within reason, you know, to try to get a deal, and that's what we tried to do.
Well, let me follow up on one thing you said about how I agree with you. I think the paradigm is changing, and I think eventually we're going to head up to a place where the revenue that these owners get for how good the product is going to be roughly the same as what they got under whatever the old model was. I think what scares these guys is that the old model was guaranteed. They know exactly how much money they're getting from season tickets, and they know how much money they're getting from every game and things like that. And now you're talking about this different world where who knows what broadband rights will be, and who knows what the local TV revenue and all that stuff. Why wouldn't you just do a shorter deal? Because
I would love to
do
that. I'm prepared to do. Matter of fact, why don't they agree to just exercise their option? And why don't we continue to negotiate and let's get back to playing?
Hold on,
everything
what does that
is
mean?
Open, and we will make some adjustments to get through this season. Why don't we do that? They're
what
the one.
Exercise?
They're proposing a 10-year deal. I've never talked longer than a 6-year deal. But more importantly, let me tell you what I've said to them. I hear what you're saying. That's why when we came to the table last week, and they were at 50, we felt we're at 53. I said, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we do a band? We'll do a band of 50 to 53, so that we'll have the protection that the number won't go lower than 50, and you have the protection that it won't go any higher than 53, and in all probability it'll probably float somewhere between 51.5 or 52.5, something like that, over 6 years. And that way, you know, you have the confidence that you're not going to have to take a hit if the economy goes down, because players' salaries and BRI, the portion that players get, is all pegged to revenue sharing. It's all pegged to either the growth or the reduction in income. But they weren't willing to do that. But more importantly, what I'd also said to them, and they adopted this, I said, listen, here's what will happen. I'm prepared to give you an opt-out. So if you do a 6-year deal, I'll give you an opt-out like you had an opt-out in 1998, 3 years in or 2 years in, wherever you think you want it. But more importantly, let me say this to you, that I'm sensitive, and I'm talking to the owners. I said, I'm sensitive to the fact that, like you, I'm concerned about the economy. I said, but I'm not a fool, and neither are the players. So if things become so desperate or dire that we have to sit down 2 or 3 years out and tear up the agreement and do another agreement, trust me, if things are that bad, there's no way in the world that the players are going to stand in the way of that. So I offered them to opt out. I said that if things get really bad, then, you know, there's no way in the world we can stand there and say, hey, you know, if your franchise is going under, people are losing jobs, and we're going to say, no, we have to hang in there with the deal we got. And I said every player would be receptive to that. And that's, to me, that's just nothing but pure common sense. So when you talk about their concern, we gave them cost certainty in 2005, and it's worked. We never got a dime above what we're supposed to get. But what they're now saying is after 12 or 13 years, the system that we're having, it doesn't work. And so we said, okay, we're prepared to make an adjustment to the system, so we're accommodating your economic loss, but you can't come and tell us now, you know, you want to completely roll back contracts, you want to eliminate guarantees, you want a hard cap, you want to restrict the use of the other exceptions, you know, one after another ad infinitum. And so that's where the struggle is. But like I said, we're open. And that's why I said to them the other night, look, you've given us to give it or take it or leave it. And after the first time they presented it, and we thought we were through for the night, we went back into the room. I caucused with our guys. And then I said, well, let's go back again just to make sure that what they're saying is true. And so we came back into the room, and they brought Peter Holt and Adam Silver back in, and they said, that's right, you heard us right. It's take it or leave it. I said, well, why don't you park your 50-50? Meaning, if that's where you are, I'm not asking you to compromise your number. I'm not asking you to reconsider your number or do anything. I said, but since we're kind of bogged down on that, let's go talk about the system. Because if we're able to talk about the system and resolve some of these other issues on the luxury tax, on the exceptions, et cetera, then maybe we can come back. I said, and maybe your 50-50 will be more palatable to the union and the players than it currently is. And they said, no, it's 50-50, et cetera. So we went back into our respective rooms again, back to our corners. And then I came back out, and I then personally went in before the owners. You know, I asked them to come into the room. And I said, listen, you know, what I just want to make sure that I'm hearing you right, that it's take it or leave it. You know, at 50-50, I said, but I'm saying to you, I'm urging that you consider just parking it. And let's talk about these other issues and see if we can get some resolution on them, which I think we may be able to do that. And if you're willing to stay and have the negotiations. There were owners in the room who wanted to do it, okay? But then they asked me to leave the room, and I think they asked me to leave the room because I think those in charge of the room might have been losing control.
Right.
And they then informed me 20 minutes later that no, they sent a message saying no, that was their position. That it was either we had to agree to the 50-50 in order to discuss anything else. And I said,
so it sounds like
never in the history of our negotiations or discussions have we ever put a precondition on them about anything. And so all of a sudden they resorted to the preconditions.
But I mean, couldn't we just say let's just do a 2-year thing where we just split everything each side wants right down the middle, and then we try to create a new system from there that lasts?
Well, I don't know about that. I think if we're 50-50, we're really not at 50-50 because they get to deduct something like $600-700 million off the top. So we're less than 50-50, you know, if truth be told.
Right.
But what I'm saying to you is, we're prepared to sit down and, you know, and consider whatever is reasonable within reason in order to get a deal. If it means what you're proposing, let's think about something for 2 years and then come back 2 years from now. I'm open. You go and sell that idea and call me up.
I want to be the federal mediator.
Hey, Bill, I think if I had
you in the room. What are my qualifications?
If I had you in the room and you knew what was going on, I think that you might be able to make it happen.
Well, it does seem from your side, with the big TV deal, I think, comes up in 2016.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, you look at what the NFL gave away 10 years, and then right after they gave those 10 years up, they went and they re-signed TV deals, and they're doing that now, and they're probably going to make even more money.
So we expect the same thing to happen, Bill. So you can understand
you don't want
my
that
reticence. I don't want to be sandbagged.
Right. You don't want that to happen.
That's
correct. Is it fair? You know David for, I mean, you've been dealing with him, negotiating with him, battling him for like 15 years. Would you consider him a friend at this point, or is he an adversary, or somewhere in between? Adversary.
Well, I mean, when you say friend, you know, we don't socialize. I mean, we have a professional relationship, a respectful relationship. You know, I like David. I don't dislike him as a person. The irony is, let me let you in on a secret. Dave and I are fraternity brothers.
What do you mean?
What do you mean? What I mean?
Oh,
what,
you mean you were?
Did you ever play frat when you were in college?
Oh, but so you just were in different frats and from different.
No,
you were
we
same
were,
frat
we
from
were,
different
we,
colleges.
We were the same frat, different college campuses. I was at Syracuse. He was at Rutgers, but we were both members of the Sammy Sigma Alpha Mu.
All right, I got scared there. I thought you went to the same college. I was confused.
No. We weren't that close. I went to college with. Of all people, I was a frat brother with Peter Goober, who owns the Golden State Warriors.
Oh.
We were frat brothers together at Syracuse in Sammy.
So, you know, in last week, Brian Gumbel compared Stern to a modern-day plantation owner. You know, that took this whole thing in a direction that I'm not sure it needed to go. Did you feel any obligation to kind of stand up and stick up for David? Or, you know, why didn't you speak up on that?
Well, I didn't think it was going to get any traction. It was Brian Gumbel's opinion. I think when I look at it, I think what happens is David is a hard charger, and David pretty much treats everybody the same. But obviously, when you got the setup that you currently have, where you got a league that's predominantly black, and then you've got a group of white owners, it may take on a different color or appearance. But no, I don't think David is racist at all.
But why does it have to take on a different appearance? I mean, the NFL, they don't have as many African-American players as the NBA.
Well, I don't know. I think just simply because people like Brian and others are left to draw the conclusions that they wish to draw.
Right. But that's not healthy for this whole thing, I don't think.
Well, I mean, but listen, you know, it's not healthy. It's not healthy. But that's just the nature of life in America. That's all.
Yeah.
I mean, people make those assumptions every day. The difference is, that, you know, we're on Front Street because we're very visible with professional sports, etc. And so people will make comments and render opinions that they think, I guess, move their own agendas.
What about on Thursday, somebody asked you about the league's desire to improve its competitive balance, and you answered, I think it's all about putting money in their pocket. Explain that answer.
Oh, well, when I say that, what I'm saying to you is that if you talk about having a hard cap, if you're talking about reducing player contracts, at one time we were talking about a $45, $44 million hard cap system, where in our current system, where this year the team cap was at $58 million, but teams could spend up to like $69 or $70 million.
Right.
Under the original proposal, it was going to be something like $44 million with a hard cap, which meant that every player's salary would get compressed. So if you take the guys at the high end, just hypothetically, or as an example, let me give you Kobe Bryant, who makes, let's say he made $24 million this past year. The max he would have been able to earn would have been $11 million. So we were going to come up with a system to address the concerns of a few teams in the real small markets, right? And thereby impose a system on everybody else. So if the L.A. Lakers have just signed a new contract for $200 million, and all of a sudden we've got a hard cap that kicks in at 55, then what are we going to do with all those millions that they're generating, you know, based upon the services that are provided by our players? If our players are generating billions of dollars, why shouldn't they share at a much higher level? So what I'm saying to you is what it would do is if you adopted their system, it would immediately increase the value, the franchise value. So these franchise values would go through the roof. People would be lining up to buy them if you knew that you're going to have revenues of $5 or $6 billion, and the most you're going to be spending out would be $2 billion a year in player costs. Then why wouldn't you want to buy a franchise? And so what I'm saying to you is that all of those savings would not be spent on players, because there wouldn't be any need to, because there'd be a prohibition, it would be legislated, thereby preventing the expenditure of any money. So when we start talking about competitive balance, et cetera, you know, or parity in terms of performance on the field, then we just don't buy it, because I said the reality is there's going to be a lot of money that a lot of people are going to make, and they're not going to put it on the teams because they don't have to. They wouldn't have to pay it because of the system. And so where would you put it? You put it in your pocket, or you invest it in something else, or your franchise is down shot up significantly in value, so you go and sell it. And there'll be people lined up to buy it.
Well, in fairness to them, people aren't lining up to buy the teams now. I mean, they can't even find an owner for New Orleans.
Well, that's not true. That's not true.
It's
Larry
not true.
Ellison offered. Larry Ellison offered to buy the New Orleans team. The problem
was
that
move
Larry
him.
Ellison said that they assumed that once he bought it, he would move it from New Orleans to San Jose or somewhere like that. They've got
he
people
would've.
Lined up to buy it, but people are waiting to see what the deal is before they purchase. I can assure you, once the deal goes down, if it looks anything like the NBA wants it to look, there's not going to be a problem selling any of these franchises. They know it, I know it, and I suspect you know it.
Well, do you think the league has too many teams? Because it seems like you're talking about over and over again that the big market owners trying to accommodate the small market owners. Are we trying too hard to accommodate them?
Yeah, Bill, what I'm saying is that the small market owners are saying that they need to have revenue sharing, a more aggressive and robust revenue sharing program in order for them to compete. They want a system like the NFL has, so that a team like Green Bay that's in a very small market, they can compete with everybody else. And so obviously there's some pushback from these bigger owners who are saying, wait a minute, we don't like the way you manage your teams, and maybe it has more to do with the way you run your teams and the choices you make than this issue of you being in a small market. So that when you consider those arguments, I'm not so sure that the arguments that are being made by the small markets necessarily justify all it is that they're demanding. Now, I understand that they're talking about putting a system in place where they would have to perform at a certain level in order to share in the revenue that they would get from the big market teams. But I know in a case of a guy like Mark Cuban, he's saying, listen, I spend millions of dollars a year marketing and promoting my team, and why should I have to share it with someone else who I don't think manages their team properly?
I got to ask you about the salary structure, though, because, you know, the system we have now, the middle class guys, seems to me like, for the most part, make too much money. The superstars don't make enough. I mean, do you think the way this structure is now, are we rewarding mediocre players too much, and are we not taking care of the superstars enough?
Well, if we go with the proposal that Mark Cuban had, then that will eliminate all these concerns and issues that you're now raising, because clearly the teams would then be free to pay who they want to pay. But there would still be enough money, I would think, under his proposal, depending on where we set the limits, for everyone to get paid. But keep in mind now, once you reduce contract length, and that's what they're arguing to us, once you reduce contract length, it's going to put more, according to them, more money into the system, because they'll be able to get rid of non-producing players.
Yes.
They'll be able to then
That's
pay
true.
That money to someone else. Our position all along was based upon the original proposal that what would happen would be, the guys at the top end would get more, but even their salaries would be drastically reduced, because if you end up with a team salary cap of $44 or $45 million or $50 million, then it means that there's less money to go around. And so while the guys at the upper end would make more, we'd probably have two classes. The guys at the top, but you could only probably end up paying maybe three max players on your team.
Yeah.
And then everyone else would be down at the minimum salary level. For the most part, you would have eliminated the mid-level, middle-class player. Now, keep in mind, under our proposal, we agreed to reduce. We have reduced the mid-level, you know, from the $5.8 million it was this year to five. So we've taken $800,000 away, and we talked about having to even grow at a much slower pace. We're convinced that everybody can get paid, you know, under the proposal that we've submitted to them, and that it'll be a fair and just system.
Yeah, but at some point, if you're cutting money out of the total salaries, one group is going to have to suffer. Either the upper-class superstars are going to have to suffer, or the middle-class guys are going to have to suffer. Do you feel like you can get this deal done without one of those classes suffering?
I think so. We're of the opinion, at least based upon the numbers that we've run, what we've told our players right now, for example, assuming we were able to do a deal of 53 or 52, all of our players who got paid a year ago, would everyone be grandfathered in, there would be no rollbacks, and every player who's a free agent this year would be able to get his market. And going forward, because of the projected growth, and we're using the NBA's numbers, there would be enough growth in the system every year to enable our players to continue to get paid like they're being paid.
Yeah. But as a fan, you know, the contracts that frustrate me, and I don't think the players union has really taken any accountability for this. Mm-hmm. It's the non-all-stars that are making, you know, $6 to $10 million a year for 4 to 5 years. Those are the contracts that kill the league. Paying Kobe $16 million, paying LeBron $50 million, those are fine. Those guys deserve that money. But, and I don't want to name names, and I'm not going to put you in that spot, but we know.
No, but Bill, I know where you're going. But the problem with that, Bill, is that you're talking about maybe 6 or 7 guys in the league, you know, maybe 10 guys at most who fall in that category. What we tend to do, we tend to kind of overemphasize, and we paint the picture, give the impression that it's endemic within the league. There's about, you know, 5 or 10, maybe 10 guys who fall within that category. And what we're saying, first of all, no team is required to give a player a guaranteed contract. No team is required to sign a guy for 5 or 6 years. And it's so funny because I know in one of your comments you talked about intellectual capital when it came to the negotiations. Well, I can use that argument with you and say, well, when it comes to parity and competition, the players seem, I think they know more about what it takes to put together a winning team than most of the people that run these franchises, because when we sit in the rooms and in the negotiations, the players will point up time after time about how they couldn't understand why a given team gave a particular player the contract that they gave him. And they're saying that there's no way in the world. I said, all the guys around the league are laughing because we know these guys don't deserve these contracts.
Yeah, but
and what
Bill,
has
we
to
know.
Happen, then they got to stop recycling some of these GMs, and they need to go out and find people who really know how to you know, conduct the evaluations that are necessary in order to award the contracts to the right guys. But what you do, if we've agreed, we have the shortest individual contract length in all of pro sports. We'd come down in 2005. You could do a 7- and 8-year deal. We went down to 6 and 5. We currently put on the table that players that they can do a 5-year contract for a Bird player and 4 years for everyone else. Now, I can assure you, in that system, a lot of players are not going to get guaranteed contracts. So that's what we're seeing more and more, that teams are signing guys with shorter contracts, and they're not giving them the guarantees. And I'm convinced that this is a new trend, and I think it's going to become permanent. I think more and more teams are going to be reluctant to give guys long-term contracts, and they're going to be less likely to guarantee them. There are going to be more players on the bubble, so if they don't produce within a year or two, three at the most, they're going to be out the door.
We
put that system in place, and we think we've been reasonable. You know, we've tried to, you know, we understand the concerns that the owners have expressed, and so we tried to address them.
But Billy, we saw last summer we had more dumb contracts that were handed out last summer than maybe any other summer, and this is when these guys knew a lockout was coming.
Yeah, but Bill, that's not the union's problem. I don't negotiate.
I feel like
contract.
It is part of your problem, though. I mean,
part of it in what way? What? Let me ask you. Tell me what you would do. Give me your advice. Come on, I got
just
you.
Just hear me out.
You're one of the main, you're one of the big pundits out there now. I read your stuff all the time. Now, come on, give me your answer.
Hear me out.
Go ahead.
I think it's good for you, for the fans to like you and to feel like, you know, they're not watching these guys. You know, like I was in the position with Baron Davis and the Clippers where he was out of shape. And he did sign a 5-year contract, and he just, you know, just didn't look like he really cared about being in shape and playing for that money. That's bad for you. That's bad for your union. And you know, I don't think contracts should be longer than 4 years. I really don't.
I don't agree with that. I think that
I know
already,
you don't. You're the player's head. Of course,
yeah,
you're not
gonna
agree.
But keep in mind, you know, also when you talk about that, negotiated salaries have gone down. I mean, that's why for the first time ever, the NBA had to write a check to us, to the players, to the union, because of the difference in BR, the guaranteed BRI, versus where it actually came in. But I understand what you're saying. Then what you'd have to do is you negotiate provisions. You put provisions and clauses in the players' contracts that say, you know, if they don't come to the camp in shape, or if they do this, that, and the other, there are
ways. You guys block all that stuff, though.
Pardon?
a lot of that stuff they've tried to do, and you guys have blocked a lot of it. I mean, you're talking about a league that the Trust Freewell got paid after choked his coach.
Let me ask you this: would they? You think you could sell the NBA on the idea of an arbitration? So if you had any guy at any given moment who you didn't think was performing and didn't deserve the contract, you could go to arbitration. But on the other hand, if we thought a guy was being underpaid, then we could go to arbitration on that.
Yeah, but that's logical. And nothing about this whole process
is that logical. I'm with you. Well, but I'm saying we're open to that kind of stuff, but the league is not open to it. They want it both ways. They want their cake and eat it too.
I mean, you look at somebody like Kevin Love, who has outperformed his rookie contract.
Right.
That's somebody that Minnesota, like in baseball, Tampa Bay, a couple years ago, the Evan Longoria, they gave him a long-term contract for more money than he would have been, than his rookie contract would have been. They got like 2 extra years out of it, but he got a lot more money than he would have gotten. I don't understand why the NBA doesn't work like that. It seems like it should.
Well, they don't want that kind of system. First of all, when the proposal they gave to us, they didn't want a system that enabled players to get paid bonuses in exchange for reduction in contract or contract length. They didn't want anything like that. They wanted no bonuses. They wanted the football system where guys would not be guaranteed a thing so that they could just, at any given moment tell a guy to, to hit the road. And there's
okay.
No support. I mean, if you're a union, there's certain things that you can go along with. We obviously, I want the NBA to thrive and be vital, and I want fans like you and others to be happy. And I think that we're going to put things in this next agreement that's going to address, everybody's concerns. But I think right now, the hook is not what it is we propose. I think the hook is because of the battle in the room between the big markets and the small markets. You know, I don't hear the owners crying when they get a guy who's in the rookie wage scale, right?
Derrick Rose.
As on the page, you take a guy like Derrick Rose, who was MVP this year. He's an MVP after 2 years, almost 3 years in the league. And he's locked into the rookie scale. Nobody's talking about increasing his salary. I don't hear the same kind of cry. I don't hear him crying about, clamoring about underpaying Blake Griffin, or when Chris Paul was there, he being underpaid. You know, he was locked into the rookie scale for 5 years before he could get paid. And in most instances, most of these guys are probably going to get one bite at the apple anyway, and, before they grow whiskers.
See, now this is all stuff I love, and I wish this is all big picture logical stuff, and I feel like both sides are so immersed in the small picture stuff. These are the discussions I thought I would be hearing, and I'm not hear enough of them. Last question, because I know you have to go.
No, we're having them. We're having those discussions.
Okay, good.
There's not a lot. There's a lot of inertia.
Right. Mm-hmm. Last question, because I know you got to go. It seemed like you guys were really close 2 weeks ago, and then it was, various reports about KG, Paul Pierce, Kobe coming in, telling the owners, 53, we're not going any bit lower.
Right.
Do you feel like you handled that well?
Yeah, that really didn't. That's not what happened. Was this. You know, when you see that there's pushback from both sides, and we knew that the owners were dug in, and I get information just like you get information of what's going on in the respective camps, and like I say, I've been of the opinion that the owners were out to break the players, to break the union, etc.
I agree.
And I wanted them to get a feel for some of what I'm experiencing when I go around and I have the meetings with the players. Because you said, you even referenced that early on in the conversation when you said, well, what leverage do you have? And I said, well, what the leverage we have is the solidarity of our players. And so I wanted them to understand, because I've been saying to them time and again, look, if you think that you're going to break these players, trust me, I said to them, I'm the most malleable guy in the room. I'm the pacifist. I'm trying to get a deal. And anything within reason, I can go back and sell to my players. But if you're dug in and you're saying that it's got to be one way or the other, then I got to let you hear from my guy. Now, at the time, they were like at about 45, right? They were at 45 and we had 53. And we had come down from 57. And so the players, my players around the league are saying, you've given up too much. Why did you ever move off of 57? So I just wanted them to see, to experience firsthand, the kind of reaction I was getting from within my camp. So that's why they came. But I can assure you that we were of the opinion last week that we were really within the zone, that we were so close to striking a deal.
Yeah.
And that's why I got kind of blown away. And I think it was when Paul Allen came in, and they specifically said in the meeting that Paul Allen came in to deliver the message from the general membership of owners that, you know, that they think they've given up too much and they're dug in, and, you know, we're either going to have to accept it or, you know, they're prepared to blow the system or blow up the season.
Right.
But no, well, all I'm saying to you, Bill, is, you know, don't be deluded by that, okay?
All right.
They were there, and, you know, the guys are pretty open and sensitive, and I think what happens is it depends upon the reaction they get within the room that it causes them to react in response to that. So that while it might appear that they were really, really dug in, I'm saying to you, when I came in there and I said, listen, you're at 50, or, well, they said, no, we're not at 50, we're at 47. I said, wait, you made an announcement to the world a week ago that you were at 50. Now you're telling me you're back at 47. I said, that thing is like out in cyberspace. You can't ever take that back, which is what they always tell me when we put something on the table. You can't take it back. So I said, let's assume you're at 50. We're at 53. Then I think we can make a deal. Let's just do a band, and it'll float. You know, it could be 51. It could be 50. It could be 53, et cetera. And that way you have the protection that you need, and we have the protection that we need. And let's go ahead and do this deal. Let's put it to bed. But then that's when they went in a different direction on us. So here we are. We're out in there trying to put this thing back on the track. But I think a guy like you, with your fan base, and I know that the NBA reads the stuff that you write, because I've heard that many times, that, you know, hopefully you can create an interest, you know, a desire on their part, because I'm telling you that I'm ready to go back to the table. And so I'm going to hope that you're going to drive them back there too.
Well, as a fan, I can just tell you I'm Switzerland in this whole thing. I blame everybody, and I'm really disappointed that we're not having a season. I was looking forward to it.
I think it would have been
one of the best seasons ever.
Don't say we're not having a season. Bill, we've only canceled the first 2 weeks. This thing is not over by a long shot.
Well, when's your next meeting?
Well, who
is
knows? Maybe it may be this week. No, I'll be calling them to see whether or not they want to get together. And if they don't want to get together, I'm going to call you back and tell you. I'm going to call you back and tell you if they still say, the only way we can meet is if I agree to a 50, to accept their 50-50. That's
right.
The only way we can meet on the other issues that have to be resolved. And to me, that's a non-starter. There's no way in the world. I can't agree to meet and not know what's going to happen on these other issues unless I accept their 50-50. That's just intolerable.
Well, I'm excited that you guys actually seem to be talking about real things that would change how the league operates.
Oh, we are, and more importantly, I'm prepared to talk back to you whenever you want to talk to me.
All right, I'm going to take you up on that, Billy Hunter.
No, trust me. Listen,
I'm
not running from you. I've been anxious. I've been waiting.
Okay, good.
I got upset when you did David Stern, and I said, wait, what is this? What's going on? I mean, how come I can't get on Bill Simmons' podcast?
What am I going to turn you down?
Bill Simmons.
Well, email me. I'm not going to turn you down if you want to come on a podcast.
Yeah, well, I didn't know. I mean, I kind of jumped on my PR man, Dan Washington. I said, what's going on, man? How come I can't talk to Bill Simmons?
Did you enjoy the experience?
Bill, I'm a fan of yours, man. Of course I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward
to it. All right, I had fun, too.
I'm looking forward to the day when we get this deal done, and I'm going to come out, and I'm going to go to a game with you, one of the Clippers games or the Lakers games. I'm going to come. I know you got season tickets.
I'll
come out and say, hey, come on, be my guest, and we'll sit together.
I would love it. I really hope you get this deal done. I hope you guys get back in the room this week.
I'm going to work hard to get it.
Good luck.
I'm giving you my word. I'm going to work hard to get it.
All right. Good luck, Billy Hunter. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So I get to sign off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.